would recognize first and things like that, a big storytelling session would get underway on our front porch, and very funny stories at the expense of preachers and congregations would get told. No doubt these tales of God, the devil, animals, and natural elements seemed ordinary enough to most people in the village, but many of them stirred up fancies in me. It did not surprise me at all to hear that the animals talked. I had suspected it all along, or let us say that I wanted to suspect it. Life took on a bigger perimeter by expanding on these things. I picked up glints and gleams out of what I heard and stored it away to turn it to my own uses. The wind would soft through the tops of the tall, long-leaf pines and said things to me. I put in the words that the sounds put into me, like, "Woo, woo, you woo." The tree was talking to me, even when I did not catch the words. It was talking and telling me things. I have mentioned the tree near our house that got so friendly I named it the Loving Pine. Finally, all of my playmates called it that, too. I used to take a seat at the foot of that tree and play for hours without any other toys. We talked about everything in my world. Sometimes we just took it out in singing songs. That tree had a mighty fine bass voice when it really took a notion to let it out. There was another tree that used to creep up close to the house around sundown and threaten me. It used to put on a skull head with a crown on it every day at sundown and make motions at me when I had to go out on the back porch to wash my feet after supper before going to bed. It never bothered around during the day. It was just another pine tree about 100 feet tall then, standing head and shoulders above a grove. But let the dusk begin to fall, and it would put that crown on its skull and creep in close. Nobody else ever seemed to notice what it was up to but me. I used to wish it would go off somewhere and get lost. But every evening I would have to look to see, and every time it would be right there, sort of shaking and shivering and bowing its head at me. I used to wonder if sometime it was not going to come in the house. When I began to make up stories, I cannot say. Just from one fancy to another, adding more and more detail until they seemed real. People seldom see themselves changing. It is like going out in the morning or in the springtime to pick flowers. You pick and you wander till suddenly you find that the light is gone and the flowers are withered in your hand. Then you say that you must turn back home. But you have wandered into a place and the gates are closed. There is no more sharp sunlight. Gray meadows are all about you, where blooms only the asphodel. You look back through the immutable gates to where the sun still shines on the flowered fields with nostalgic longing. But God pointed men's toes in one direction. One is surprised by the passage of time and the distance traveled. But one may not go back. So I was making little stories to myself, and have no memory of how I began, but I do remember some of the earliest ones. I came in from play one day, and told my mother how a bird had talked to me, with a tail so long that while he sat up in the top of the pine tree, his tail was dragging the ground. It was a soft, beautiful bird tail, all blue and pink and red and green. In fact, I climbed up the bird's tail and sat up the tree and had a long talk with the bird. He knew my name, but I didn't know how he knew it. In fact, the bird had come a long way just to sit and talk with me. Another time, I dashed into the kitchen and told Mama how the lake had talked with me and invited me to walk all over it. I told the lake I was afraid of getting drowned, but the lake assured me it wouldn't think of doing me like that. No, indeed. Come right on and have a walk. Well, I stepped out on the lake and walked all over it. It didn't even wet my feet. I could see all the fish and things swimming around under me, and they all said hello, but none of them bothered me. Wasn't that nice? My mother said that it was. My grandmother glared at me like open-faced hell and snorted,
"Lucy!" she lisped. "You hear that youngin' stand up here and lie like that, and you ain't doing nothing to break her of it? Grab her, wring her coattails over her head, and wear out a handful of peach hickories on her backside. Stomp her guts out. Ruin her."
"Oh, she's just playing," Mama said indulgently.
"Playing? Why, that little heifer is lying just as fast as a horse can trot. Stop her. Wear her backside out. I bet if I lay my hands on her, she'll stop it. I abominate, a lying tongue."
Mama never tried to break me. She'd listen sometimes, and sometimes she wouldn't. But she never seemed displeased. But her mother used to foam at the mouth. I was just as sure to be hung before I got grown as gun was iron. The least thing Mama could do to straighten me out was to smack my jaws for me. She outraged my grandmother scandalously by not doing it. Mama was going to be responsible for my downfall when she stood up in judgment. It was a sin before the living justice, that's what it was. God knows Grandmother would break me or kill me if she had her way. Killing me looked like the best one anyway. All I was good for was to lay up and wet the bed half of the time and tell lies, besides being the spitting image of that good-for-nothing yellow bastard. I was the punishment God put on Mama for marrying Papa. I ought to be thrown in the hog slops, that's what. She could beat me as long as I last. I knew that I did not have to pay too much attention to the old lady, and so I didn't. Furthermore, how was she going to tell what I was doing inside? I could keep my inventions to myself, which was what I did most of the time. One day we were going to have roasting ears for dinner, and I was around while Mama was shucking the corn. I picked up an inside chuck and carried it off to look at. It was such a delicate, blushy green. I crawled under the side of the house to love it all by myself. In a few minutes, it had become Miss Cornshuck, and of course, needed some hair. So I went back and picked up some corn silk and tied it to the pointed end. We had a lovely time together for a day or two, and then Miss Cornshuck got lonesome for some company. I did not think that her lonesomeness would have come down on her as it did if I had not found a cake of sweet soap in Mama's dresser drawer. It was a cake of pears-scented soap. It was clear, like amber glass. I could see straight through it. It delighted my senses just as much as the tender green Cornshuck. So Miss Cornshuck fell in love with Mr. Sweet Smell then and there. But she said she could not have a thing to do with him unless he went and put on some clothes. I found a piece of red and white string that had come around some groceries and made him a suit of clothes. Being bigger in the middle than he was on either end, his pants kept falling off, sometimes over his head and sometimes the other way. So I cut little notches in his sides around the middle and tied his suit on. To other people, it might have looked like a cake of soap with a bit of twine tied around it. But Miss Cornshuck and I knew he had on the finest clothes in the world. Every day it would be different, because Mr. Sweet Smell was very particular about what he wore. Besides, he wanted Miss Cornshuck to admire him. There was a great mystery about where Mr. Sweet Smell came from. I suppose if Mama had been asked, she would have said that it was the company soap, since the family used nothing but plain yellow octagon laundry soap for bathing. But I had not known it was there until I happened to find it. It might have been there for years. Whenever Miss Cornshuck asked him where his home was, he always said it was a secret which he would tell her about when they were married. It was not very important anyway. We knew he was some very high-class man from way off. The farther off, the better. But sad to say, Miss Cornchuck and Mr. Sweet Smell never got married. They always meant to, but before very long, Miss Corn Cob began to make trouble. We found her around the kitchen door one day, and she followed us back under the house and right away started her meanness. She was jealous of Miss Corn Chuck because she was so pretty and green with long, silky hair, and so Miss Corn Cob would make up all kinds of mean stories about her. One day, there was going to be a big party, and that was the first time that the spool people came to visit. They used to hop off of Mama's sewing machine one by one until they were a great congregation, at least 15 or so. They didn't do anything much besides second the motion on what somebody else did and said, so they must have been the common people. Reverend Doorknob was there, too. He used to live on the inside of the kitchen door, but one day he rolled off and came under the house to be with us. Unconsciously, he behaved a lot like Mayor Joe Clark. He was roundish and reddish brown and used to laugh louder than anything when something funny happened. The spool people always laughed whenever he laughed. They used to cry, too, whenever Mr. Sweet Smell or Miss Corn Shuck cried. They were always doing whatever they saw other people do. That was the way the spool people were. When Mr. Sweet Smell left his fine house in the dresser drawer that day, he came through the kitchen and brought a half can of condensed milk for the refreshments. Everybody liked condensed milk for refreshment. Well, Miss Corn Cob sneaked around and ate up all the refreshments, and then she told everybody that Miss Corn Chuck ate it. That hurt Mr. Sweet Smell's feelings so bad till he went home, and so he didn't marry Miss Corn Chuck that day. Reverend Doorknob was so mad with Miss Corn Cob that he threw her clear over the house, and she landed in the horse trough, which everybody said served her just right. But not getting married that day sort of threw Mr. Sweet Smell in a kind of fever. He was sick in the bed for several days. Miss Corn Chuck went to see him every day, and that was very nice. He rubbed off some of his smell on her because she was so nice to come see him. Some people might have thought that Miss Corn Chuck's green dress had faded and her silky hair all dried up, but that was because they didn't know any better. She just put on a brownish cloak over it so it wouldn't get dirty. She would let me see it any time I wanted to. That was because she liked me better than anyone else, except Mr. Sweet Smell. She lay under the mattress of my bed every night. Mr. Sweet Smell always went home, to the dresser drawer. The spool people slept on the sill under the house because Reverend Doorknob used to sleep there. They couldn't do a thing unless they saw somebody else doing it. They wore a string around their waist, trying to dress up like Mr. Sweet Smell. Miss Corn Cob played a very mean trick once. Miss Corn Chuck and Mr. Sweet Smell were going to get married down by the lake. The lake had kindly moved into the wash basin for the occasion. A piece of cold cornbread had turned into a magnificent cake. Plenty of eggnog had come out of a cake of shaving soap. The bride and groom were standing side by side and ready. Then what did Miss Corn Cob do? She shoved Reverend Doorknob into the lake because she knew he couldn't swim. Here everybody was waiting, and nobody would have known where the preacher was if one of the spool people had not seen him kicking down at the bottom of the lake and rescued him. While he was getting dry and putting on a fresh suit of clothes, Miss Corn Cob sent our old Dominecker rooster to steal the wedding cake. So the wedding had to be put off until Christmas, because then there would be plenty of cake for everybody. The spool people said they were glad of it, because there ought to be enough cake to go around if you wanted a really nice wedding. The lake told everybody goodbye, jumped out in the yard, and went on home. It could not stay off too long, because it would be missed and people would not know what to think. Miss Corn Cob went and hid down a gopher hole for a whole week. Every night she used to cry so loud that we could hear her at the house. You see, she was scared of the dark. Her mama gave her a good whipping when she got back home, and everybody stood around and said, "Goody, goody, 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 goody," because that makes everybody feel bad. That is, no child likes to hear another one gloating "goody" when he is in trouble. They all stayed around the house for years, holding funerals and almost weddings, and taking trips with me to where the sky met the ground. I do not know exactly when they left me. They kept me company for so long. Then one day, they were gone. Where? I do not know. But there is an age when children are fit company for spirits, before they have absorbed too much of earthy things to be able to fly with the unseen things that soar. There came a time when I could look back on the fields where we had picked flowers together, but they, my friends, were nowhere to be seen. The sunlight where I had lost them was still of Midas gold, but that which touched me where I stood had somehow turned to gilt. Nor could I return to the shining meadow where they had vanished. I could not ask of others if they had seen which way my company went. My friends had been too shy to show themselves to others. Now and then, when the sky is the right shade of blue, the air soft and the clouds are sculptured into heroic shapes, I glimpse them for a moment and believe again that the halcyon days have been. When inanimate things ceased to commune with me like natural men, other dreams came to live with me. Animals took on lives and characteristics which nobody knew anything about except myself. Little things that people did or said grew into fantastic stories. There was a man who turned into an alligator for my amusement. All he did was live in a one-room house by himself down near Lake Bell. I did the rest myself. He came into the village one evening near dusk and stopped at the store. Somebody teased him about living out there by himself and said that if he did not hurry up and get married, he was liable to go wild. I saw him tending his little garden all day and otherwise just being a natural man. But I made an image of him for after dark that was different. In my imagination, his workaday hands and feet became the reptilian claws of an alligator. A tough, knotty hide crept over him, and his mouth became a huge snout with prong-toothed, powerful jaws. In the dark of the night when the alligators began their nightly mysteries behind the cloaking curtain of cypress trees that all but hid Lake Bell, I could see him crawling from his door, turning his ugly head from left to right to see who was looking, then gliding down into the dark waters to become a gator among gators. He would mingle his bellow with other bull gator bellows and be strong and terrible. He was the king of gators, and the others minded him. When I heard the thunder of bull gator voices from the lake on dark nights, I used to whisper to myself, "That's Mr. Pandeer. Just listen at him." I kept adding detail. For instance, late one afternoon, my mother had taken me for a walk down around Lake Bell. On our way home, the sun had set. It was good and dark when we came to the turning off place that would take us straight home. At that spot, the trees stood apart, and the surface of the lake was plain. I saw the early moon laying a shiny track across the water. After that, I could picture the full moon laying a flaming red sword of light across the water. It was a road of yellow-red light made for Mr. Pendeer to tread. I could see him crossing the lake down this flaming road wrapped in his awful majesty, with thousands on thousands of his subject gators moving silently along beside him and behind him in an awesome and mighty convoy. I added another chapter to the Pendeer story when a curious accident happened in the village. One old woman, Mrs. Bronson, went fishing in Blue Sink late one afternoon and did not return. The family, who had opposed the idea of a woman of Mrs. Bronson's age going off to Blue Sink to fish so late in the day, finally became worried and went out to hunt for her. They went around the edge of the lake with lanterns and torches and called, but they could not see her, and neither did she answer. Finally, they found her, though people were beginning to be doubtful about it. Blue Sink drops down abruptly from its shores and is supposed to be bottomless. She was in the lake, at the very edge, still alive, but unable to crawl out. She did not even cry out when she heard herself being called and could discern the moving lanterns. When she was safely home in bed, she said that she had sat there till sundown because she knew the fish would begin to bite. She did catch a few, but just as black dark came on, a terrible fear came on her somehow, and something like a great wind struck her and hurled her into the water. She had fallen on the narrow inside rim of the lake, otherwise she would have sunk into the hidden deeps. She said that she screamed a few times for help, but something rushed across Blue Sink like a bodified wind and commanded her to hush up. If she so much as made another sound, she would never get out of that lake alive. That was why she had not answered when she was called, but she was praying inside to be found. The doctor came and said that she had suffered a stroke. One whole side of her body was paralyzed, so when she tumbled over into the lake, she could not get out. Her terror and fear had done the rest. She must have had two or three horrible hours lying there in the edge of the water, hard put to it to keep her face above water, and expecting the attack of an alligator, water moccasin, garfish, and numerous other creatures which existed only in her terrified mind. It is a wonder that she did not die of fright. Right away, I could see the mighty tail of Mr. Pendeer slapping old Lady Bronson into the lake. Then he had stalked away across the lake like the devil, walking up and down in the earth. But when she had screamed, I pictured him recrossing to her, treading the red gold of his moon carpet, with his mighty minions swimming along beside him, his feet walking the surface like a pavement, the soles of his feet never even being damp. He drew up his hosts around her and commanded her to hush. The old woman was said to dabble in hoodoo, and some said that Pendeer did, too. I had heard often enough that it was the pride of one hoodoo doctor to throw it back on the one that done it. What could be more natural, then, than for my gator man to get peeved because the old lady had tried to throw something he did back on him? Naturally, he slapped her into the lake, no matter what the doctor said. I knew the real truth of the matter. I told my playmates about it, and they believed it right away. I got bold and told them how I had seen Mr. Pendeer turning into a gator at night and going down into the lake and walking the water. My chums even believed part of it in a way. That is, they liked the idea and joined in the game. They became timid in the presence of the harmless little man, and on the sly would be looking for gator signs on him. We pretended a great fear of him. We might meet him in gator form some night and get carried off into the lake and die on that terrible road of light. I told them how he couldn't die anyway. That is, he couldn't die anymore. He was not a living man. He had died a long time ago, and his soul had gone to the gators. He had told me that he had no fear of death because he had come back from where other folks were going. The truth of the matter was that poor Mr. Pendeer was the one man in the village who could not swim a lick. He died a very ordinary death. He worked too long in the hot sun one day, and some said on an empty stomach, and took down sick. 2 days later, he just died and was buried and stayed where he was put. His life had not agreed with my fantasy at any point. He had no female relatives around to mourn loud and make his funeral entertaining even, and his name soon ceased to be called. The grown folks of the village never dreamed what an exciting man he had been to me. Even after he was dead and buried, I would go down to the edge of Lake Bell to see if I could run across some of his gator hides that he had sloughed off at daybreak when he became a man again. My fantasies were still fighting against the facts. Chapter 6. Wandering. I knew that Mama was sick. She kept getting thinner and thinner, and her chest cold never got any better. Finally, she took to bed. She had come home from Alabama that way. She had gone back to her old home to be with her sister during her sister's last illness. Aunt Dinky had lasted on for 2 months after Mama got there, and so Mama had stayed on till the last. It seems that there had been other things there that worried her. Down underneath, it appeared that Grandma had never quite forgiven her for the move she had made 21 years before in marrying Papa. So that when Mama suggested that the old Potts place be sold so that she could bring her share back with her to Florida, her mother, urged on by Uncle Bud, Mama's oldest brother, refused. Not until Grandma's head was cold was an acre of the place to be sold. She had long since quit living on it, and it was pretty well run down, but she wouldn't, that was all. Mama could just go on back to that yellow rascal she had married like she came. I do not think that the money part worried Mama as much as the injustice and spitefulness of the thing. Then Cousin Jimmy's death seemed to come back on Mama during her visit. How he came to his death is an unsolved mystery. He went to a party and started home. The next morning, his headless body was found beside the railroad track. There was no blood, so the train couldn't have killed him. This had happened before I was born. He was said to have been a very handsome young man and very popular with the girls. He was my mother's favorite nephew, and she took it hard. She had probably numbed over her misery, but going back there seemed to freshen up her grief. Some said that he had been waylaid by 3 other young fellows and killed in a jealous rage, but nothing could be proved. It was whispered that he had been shot in the head by a white man unintentionally and then beheaded to hide the wound. He had been shot from ambush because his assailant mistook him for a certain white man. It was night. The attacker expected the white man to pass that way, but not Jimmy. When he found out his mistake, he had forced a certain Negro to help him move the body to the railroad track without the head, so that it would look as if he had been run over by the train. Anyway, that is what the Negro wrote back after he had moved to Texas years later. There was never any move to prove the charge, for obvious reasons. Mama took the whole thing very hard. It was not long after Mama came home that she began to be less active. Then she took to bed. I knew she was ailing, but she was always frail, so I did not take it too much to heart. I was 9 years old, and even though she had talked to me very earnestly one night, I could not conceive of Mama actually dying. She had talked of it many times. That day, September 18th, she had called me and given me certain instructions. I was not to let them take the pillow from under her head until she was dead. The clock was not to be covered, nor the looking glass. She trusted me to see to it that these things were not done. I promised her as solemnly as 9 years could do that I would see to it. What years of agony that promise gave me. In the first place, I had no idea that it would be soon. But that same day, near sundown, I was called upon to set my will against my father, the village dames, and village custom. I know now that I could not have succeeded. I had left Mama and was playing outside for a little while, when I noted a number of women going inside Mama's room and staying. It looked strange, so I went on in. Papa was standing at the foot of the bed looking down on my mother, who was breathing hard. As I crowded in, they lifted up the bed and turned it around so that Mama's eyes would face the east. I thought that she looked to me as the head of the bed was reversed. Her mouth was slightly open, but her breathing took up so much of her strength that she could not talk. But she looked at me, or so I felt, to speak for her. She depended on me for a voice. The master maker in his making had made Old Death, made him with big, soft feet and square toes, made him with a face that reflects the face of all things, but neither changes itself nor is mirrored anywhere. Made the body of Death out of infinite hunger, made a weapon for his hand to satisfy his needs. This was the morning of the day of the beginning of things. But Death had no home, and he knew it at once. "And where shall I dwell in my dwelling?" Old Death asked, for he was already old when he was made. "You shall build you a place close to the living, yet far out of the sight of eyes. Wherever there is a building, there you have your platform that comprehends the four roads of the winds. For your hunger, I give you the first and last taste of all things." We had been born, so Death had had his first taste of us. We had built things, so he had his platform in our yard. And now, Death stirred from his platform in his secret place in our yard and came inside the house. Somebody reached for the clock, while Mrs. Mattie Clark put her hand to the pillow to take it away.
"Don't!"
I cried out.
"Don't take the pillow from under Mama's head. She says she didn't want it moved."
I made to stop Mrs. Mattie, but Papa pulled me away. Others were trying to silence me. I could see the huge drop of sweat collected in the hollow at Mama's elbow, and it hurt me so. They were covering the clock and the mirror.
"Don't cover up that clock. Leave that looking glass like it is. Let me put Mama's pillow back where it was."
But Papa held me tight, and the others frowned me down. Mama was still rasping out the last morsel of her life. I think she was trying to say something, and I think she was trying to speak to me. What was she trying to tell me? What wouldn't I give to know? Perhaps she was telling me that it was better for the pillow to be moved so that she could die easy, as they said. Perhaps she was accusing me of weakness and failure in carrying out her last wish. I do not know. I shall never know. Just then, Death finished his prowling through the house on his padded feet and entered the room. He bowed to Mama in his way, and she made her manners and left us to act out our ceremonies over unimportant things. I was to agonize over that moment for years to come. In the midst of play, in wakeful moments after midnight, on the way home from parties, and even in the classroom during lectures, my thoughts would escape occasionally from their confines, and stare me down. Now, I know that I could not have had my way against the world. The world we lived in required those acts. Anything else would have been sacrilege, and no 9-year-old voice was going to thwart them. My father was with the Moors. He had restrained me physically from outraging the ceremonies established for the dying. If there is any consciousness after death, I hope that Mama knows that I did my best. She must know how I have suffered for my failure. But life picked me up from the foot of Mama's bed, grief, self-despisement, and all, and set my feet in strange ways. That moment was the end of a phase in my life. I was old before my time, with grief of loss, of failure, of remorse of failure. No matter what the others did, my mother had put her trust in me. She had felt that I could and would carry out her wishes, and I had not. And then in that sunset time, I failed her. It seemed, as she died, that the sun went down on purpose to flee away from me. That hour began my wanderings. Not so much in geography, but in time. Then not so much in time as in spirit. Mama died at sundown and changed a world. That is, the world which had been built out of her body and her heart. Even the physical aspects fell apart with a suddenness that was startling. My oldest brother was up in Jacksonville in school, and he arrived home after Mama had passed. By then she had been washed and dressed and laid out on the ironing board in the parlor. Practically all of the village was in the front yard and on the porch, talking in low tones and waiting. They were not especially waiting for my brother Bob. They were doing that kind of waiting that people do around death. It is a kind of sipping up the drama of the thing. However, if they were asked, they would say it was the sadness of the occasion which drew them. In reality, it is a kind of feast of the Passover. Bob's grief was awful when he realized that he was too late. He could not conceive at first that nothing could be done to straighten things out. There was no ear for his excuse nor explanation, no way to ease what was in him. Finally, it must have come to him that what he had inside, he must take with him wherever he went. Mama was there on the cooling board, with the sheet draped over her, blowing gently in the wind. Nothing there seemed to hear him at all. There was my sister Sarah in the kitchen crying and trying to quiet Everett, who was just past 2 years old. She was crying and trying to make him hush at the same time. He was crying because he sensed the grief around him, and then Sarah, who was 15, had been his nurse and he would respond to her mood, whatever it was. We were all grubby bales of misery, huddled about lamps. I have often wished I had been old enough at the time to look into Papa's heart that night. If I could know what that moment meant to him, I could have set my compass towards him and been sure. I know that I did love him in a way, and that I admired many things about him. He had a poetry about him that I loved, that had made him a successful preacher. He could hit 97 out of 100 with a gun. He could swim Lake Maitland from Maitland to Winter Park, and no man in the village could put my father's shoulders to the ground. We were so certain of Papa's invincibility in combat that when a village woman scolded Everett for some misdemeanor and told him that God would punish him, Everett just 2 years old, reared back and told her, "He better not bother me. Papa will shoot him down." He found out better later on, but that goes to show you how big our papa looked to us. We had seen him bring down bears and panthers with his gun and chin the bar more times than any man in competing distance. He had, to our knowledge, licked two men who Mama told him had to be licked. All that part was just fine with me, but I was Mama's child. I knew that she had not always been happy, and I wanted to know just how sad he was that night. I have repeatedly called up that picture and questioned it. Papa cried some, too, as he moved in his awkward way about the place, from the kitchen to the front porch and back again. He kept saying, "Poor thing. She suffered so much." I do not know what he meant by that. It could have been love and pity for her suffering ending at last. It could have been remorse mixed with relief. The hard driving force was no longer opposed to his easygoing pace. He could put his potentialities to sleep and be happy in the laugh of the day. He could do next year or never what Mama would have insisted must be done today. Rome, the eternal city, meant two different things to my parents. To Mama, it meant you must build it today so it could last through eternity. To Papa, it meant that you could plan to lay some bricks today, and you have the rest of eternity to finish it. With all that time, why hurry? God had made more time than anything else anyway. Why act so stingy about it? Then, too, I used to notice how Mama used to snatch Papa. That is, he would start to put up an argument that would have been terrific on the store porch, but Mama would pitch in with a single word or a sentence and mess it all up. You could tell he was mad as fire with no words to blow it out with. He would sit over in the corner and cut his eyes at her real hard. He was used to being a hero on the store porch and in church affairs, and I can see how he must have felt to be always outdone around home. I know now that that is a griping thing to a man, not to be able to whip his woman mentally. Some women know how to give their man that conquesting feeling. My mother took her over the creek man and bare-knuckled him from brogans to broadcloth, and I am certain that he was proud of the change in public. But in the house, he might have always felt over the creek, and because that was not the statue he had made for himself to look at, he resented it. But then, you cannot blame my mother too much if she did not see him as his entranced congregations did. The one who makes the idols never worships them, however tenderly he might have molded the clay. You cannot have knowledge and worship at the same time. Mystery is the essence of divinity. Gods must keep their distances from men. Anyway, the next day, Sam Mosley's span of fine horses, hitched to our wagon, carried my mother to Macedonia Baptist Church for the last time. The finality of the thing came to me fully when the earth began to thud on the coffin. That night, all of Mama's children were assembled together for the last time on earth. The next day, Bob and Sarah went back to Jacksonville to school. Papa was away from home a great deal, so 2 weeks later, I was on my way to Jacksonville, too. I was underage, but the school had agreed to take me in under the circumstances. My sister was to look after me, in a way. The midnight train had to be waved down at Maitland for me. That would put me into Jacksonville in the daytime. As my brother Dick drove the mile with me that night, we approached the curve in the road that skirts Lake Catherine, and suddenly, I saw the first picture of my visions. I had seen myself upon that curve at night, leaving the village home, bowed down with grief that was more than common. As it all flashed back to me, I started violently for a minute. Then I moved closer beside Dick, as if he could shield me from those others that were to come. He asked me what was the matter, and I said I thought I heard something moving down by the lake. He laughed at that, and we rode on, the lantern showing the roadway, and me keeping as close to Dick as I could. A little humped up, shabby-backed trunk was behind us in the buckboard. I was on my way from the village, never to return to it as a real part of the town. Jacksonville made me know that I was a little colored girl. Things were all about the town to point this out to me. Streetcars and stores, and then talk I heard around the school. I was no longer among the white people whose homes I could barge into with a sure sense of welcome. These white people had funny ways. I could tell that even from a distance. I didn't get a piece of candy or a bag of crackers just for going into a store in Jacksonville as I did when I went into Galloway's or Hill's at Maitland or Joe Clark's in Eatonville. Around the school, I was an awful bother. The girls complained that they couldn't get a chance to talk without me turning up somewhere to be in the way. I broke up many good he-said conferences just by showing up. It was not my intention to do so. What I wanted was for it to go full steam ahead and let me listen. But that didn't seem to please. I was not in the he-said class, and they wished I would kindly please stay out of the way. My underskirt was hanging, for instance. Why didn't I go someplace and fix it? My head looked like a hoorah's nest. Why didn't I go comb it? If I took time enough to match my stockings, I wouldn't have time to be trying to listen in on grown folks' business. These venerable old ladies were anywhere from 15 to 18. In the classroom, I got along splendidly. The only difficulty was that I was rated as sassy. I just had to talk back at established authority, and that established authority hated back talk worse than barbed wire pie. My brother was asked to speak to me in addition to a licking or two, but on the whole, things went along all right. My immediate teachers were enthusiastic about me. It was the guardians of study hour and prayer meetings who felt that their burden was extra hard to bear. School in Jacksonville was one of those twilight things. It was not dark, but it lacked the bold sunlight that I craved. I worshipped two of my teachers and loved ginger snaps with cheese and sour pickles. But I was deprived of the loving pine, the lakes, the wild violets in the woods, and the animals I used to know. No more holding down first base on the team with my brothers and their friends. Just a jagged hole where my home used to be. At times, the girls of the school were lined up two and two and taken for a walk. On one of these occasions, I had an experience that set my heart to fluttering. I saw a woman sitting on a porch who looked at a distance like Mama. Maybe it was Mama. Maybe she was not dead at all. They had made some mistake. Mama had gone off to Jacksonville, and they thought that she was dead. The woman was sitting in a rocking chair just like Mama always did. It must be Mama. But before I came abreast of the porch in my rigid place in line, the woman got up and went inside. I wanted to stop and go in, but I didn't even breathe my hope to anyone. I made up my mind to run away someday and find the house and let Mama know where I was. But before I did, the hope that the woman really was my mother passed. I accepted my bereavement. Chapter 7 Jacksonville and After. My sister moped a great deal. She was Papa's favorite child, and I am certain that she loved him more than anything on earth, my baby brother Everett being next in her love. So 2 months after I came to school, Sarah said that she was sick and wanted to go home. Papa arranged for her to leave school. That had very tragic results for Sarah. In a week or two after she left me in Jacksonville, she wrote back that Papa had married again. That hurt us all, somehow, but it was worse for Sarah, for my stepmother must have resented Papa's tender indulgence for his older daughter. It was not long before the news came back that she had insisted that Papa put Sarah out of the house. That was terrible enough, but it was not satisfactory to Papa's new wife. Papa must go over and beat Sarah with a buggy whip for commenting on the marriage happening so soon after Mama's death. Sarah must be driven out of town. So Sarah just married and went down on the Manatee River to live. She took Everett with her. She probably left more behind her than she took away. What Papa and Sarah felt during these times, I have never heard from either of them. I know that it must have plowed very deep with both of them. God, how I long to lay my hands upon my stepmother's short, pudgy hulk. No gun, no blade, no club would do. Just flesh against flesh. And leave the end of the struggle to the hidden old women who sit and spin. Papa had honored his firstborn daughter from the day of her birth. If she was not foretold, she was certainly forewished. 3 sons had come, and he was glad of their robust health, but after the first one, he wanted a little girl child around the house. For several years then, it had been a wish deferred, so that when she did arrive, small, undersized, but a girl, his joy was boundless. He changed and washed her diapers. She was not allowed to cry as an infant, and when she grew old enough to let on, her wishes did not go unregarded. What was it Papa's girl baby wanted to eat? She wanted 2 dolls instead of 1? Bless her little heart. A cheeky little rascal. Papa would bring it when he came. The 2 oldest boys had to get out of their beds late one night and stay outdoors for an hour or more because little 3-year-old Sarah woke up and looked out of the window and decided that she wanted to see the stars outdoors. It was no use for the boys to point out that she could see stars aplenty through the window. Papa thundered, "Get up and take that youngin' outdoors. Let her look at the stars just as long as she wants to, and don't let me hear a mutter out of you. If I hear 1 grumble, I'll drop your britches below your hocks and bust a hide on you." Sarah was diminutive. Even when she was small, you could tell that she never would grow much. She would be short like Papa's mother and her own mother. She had something of both of them in her face. Papa delighted in putting the finest and the softest shoes on her dainty feet. The fluffiest white organdy dresses with the stiffest ribbon sashes. "That's a switchin' little gal," he used to gloat. She had music lessons on the piano. It did not matter that she was not interested in music. It was part of his pride. The parlor organ was bought in Jacksonville and shipped down as a surprise for Sarah on her 10th birthday. She had a gold ring for her finger, and gold earrings. When I begged for music lessons, I was told to dry up before he bust the hide on my back. If the rest of us wanted to sneak jelly or preserves and get off without a licking, the thing to do was to get Sarah in on it. Papa might ignore the whipping purge that Mama was organizing until he found that Sarah was mixed up in it. Then he would lay aside the county newspaper, which he was given to reading, and shout at Mama, "That'll do! That'll do, Lulu!
I can't stand all that racket around the place.
Of course, if Mama was really in the mood, Papa's protest would change no plans. But at times it would, and we would all escape because of Sarah. I have seen Papa actually snatch the switch out of Mama's hand when she got to Sarah. But if Mama thought that the chastisement was really in order, she would send out to the peach tree for another one, and the whipping would go right on. Papa knew better than to stick his bill in when Mama was really determined. Under such circumstances, Sarah was certain to get some sort of a present on Monday when Papa came back from Sanford. He had never struck her in his life. She never got but one from him, and that was this cruel thing at the instigation of our stepmother. Neither Papa nor Sarah ever looked at each other in the same way again, nor at the world, nor did they look like the same people to the world who knew them. Their heads hung down, and they studied the ground under their feet too much. As for me, looking on, it made a tiger out of me. It did not matter so much to me that Sarah was Papa's favorite. I got my joys in other ways, and so did not miss his petting. I do not think that I ever really wanted it. It made me miserable to see Sarah look like that. And 6 years later, I paid that score off in a small way. It was on a Monday morning, 6 years after Sarah's heartbreak, that my stepmother threatened to beat me for my impudence, after vainly trying to get Papa to undertake the job. I guess that the memory of the time that he had struck Sarah at his wife's demand influenced Papa and saved me. I do not think that she considered that a changed man might be in front of her. I do not think that she thought that I would resist in the presence of my father after all that had happened and shown his lack of will. I do not think that she even thought that she could whip me if I resisted. She did think, if she thought at all, that all she had to do was to start on me, and Papa would be forced to jump in and finish up the job to her satisfaction in order to stay in her good graces. Old memories of her power over him told her to assert herself, and she pitched in. She called me a sassy, impudent heifer, announced that she was going to take me down a buttonhole lower, and threw a bottle at my head. The bottle came sailing slowly through the air and missed me easily. She never should have missed. The primeval in me leaped to life. Ha! This was the very corn I wanted to grind. Fight! Not having to put up with what she did to us through Papa? Direct action and everything up to me. I looked at her hard. And like everybody else's enemy, her looks, her smells, her sounds were all mixed up with her doings, and she deserved punishment for them as well as her acts. The feelings of all those 6 years were pressing inside me like steam under a valve. I didn't have any thoughts to speak of, just the fierce instinct of flesh on flesh, me kicking and beating on her pudgy self. Those two ugly false teeth in front, her dead on the floor, grinning like a dead dog in the sun. Consequences be damned. If I died, let me die with my hands soaked in her blood. I wanted her blood and plenty of it. That is the way I went into the fight, and that is the way I fought it. She had the advantage of me in weight. That was all. It did not seem to do her a bit of good. Maybe she did not have the guts, and certainly she underestimated mine. She gave way before my first rush and found herself pinned against the wall with my fists pounding at her face without pity. She scratched and clawed at me, but I felt nothing at all. In a few seconds, she gave up. I could see her face when she realized that I meant to kill her. She spat on my dress then, and did what she could to cover up from my renewed fury. She had given up fighting, except for trying to spit in my face, and I did not intend for her to get away. She yelled for Papa, but that was no good. Papa was disturbed, no doubt of it. But he wept and fiddled in the door and asked me to stop while her head was traveling between my fist and the